Through the nauseous night I'll soar, I'll wade through pools of rancid gore. I'll slide through clumps where maggots squirm, I'll skin dive where piranhas churn. I'll tread the reeking, oozing swamp, through corpse-filled quicksand beds I'll stomp. Through vampire nests I'll wend my way, where werewolves dwell I'll pass today. I'll lift your coffin lid, my dear, my nose will tell me you're still there. I'll realize my lifelong dream to wish you happy Halloween.
Mister, do you want to see my Halloween costume?
Igor, aren't you a little bit old to be going trick-or-treating?
But, Master, there is nothing else to do this Halloween.
On the contrary, you could listen to all of the great shows on WHFR this Halloween. You could even call into the station at 313-845-9676 and say, trick-or-treat, and WHFR will send you a Halloween grab bag.
But, Master, I don't have a telephone.
That's no problem, Igor. You could even send an email at whfr-pc@hfcc.edu and type the words trick-or-treat.
I could play all day.
Yes, Igor, you can listen all day, but only one grab bag per person.
Gee, Master, that sounds pretty groovy. Would you like to join me?
Of course, Igor. As for the rest of you, don't forget to listen to WHFR Wednesday, October 31st, and get your Halloween grab bag, too. And as always, keep listening to the station making spooky waves, WHFR.fm.
Hi, this is former Downriver resident Steve Chesney, and every time I'm in Dearborn, I listen to Mike Darnewski, Scrockin' Your
Batow,
every Sunday night from 7 until 9 p.m. on the only station making waves, WHFR
Dearborn.
Very professional.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22. Your 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, the upcoming Hunter's Moon, a controversial conviction of six scientists in Italy, new music from Danny Malone and Jazz Mills, and in the spirit of Halloween, we'll talk about the Ghoul Star. Here's your scientist soundbite.
The Hunter's Moon is the full moon after the Harvest Moon, so it's taking place in late October, specifically October 29th.
That was skywatching expert Deborah Bird. More with her later. But first, Emily Howard is here to talk news of the week. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks, Mike. Pop music megastar Lady Gaga is being honored with the name of a new genus of ferns found in Central and South America, Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. A genus is a group of closely related species. In this case, 19 species of fern will carry the name Gaga. At one stage of its life, the new genus Gaga has somewhat fluid definitions of gender and bears a striking resemblance to one of Gaga's famous costumes. Members of the new genus also bear a distinct DNA sequence spelling G-A-G-A.
NASA's Cassini spacecraft has tracked the aftermath of a rare massive storm on Saturn. Data reveal record-setting disturbances in the planet's upper atmosphere long after the visible signs of the storm abated, in addition to an indication the storm was more forceful than scientists previously thought. Check out a cool video about this event at earthsky.org.
Scientists around the world are expressing dismay over the ruling on Monday, October 22nd, by an Italian court to convict six scientists and a government official on manslaughter charges for failing to predict a 2009 earthquake. More than 300 people were killed in the earthquake. Meanwhile, seismologists and other earthquake experts around the world agree that earthquakes cannot be predicted.
We'll talk about that with Deborah Bird later in the program. Scientists have calculated that cutting food waste in half could improve global food security by providing enough extra food to feed a billion people. It could also conserve valuable natural resources, including freshwater and cropland. This study will be published in the November 1st issue of the journal Science of the Total Environment. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard.
Thanks, Emily. Song of the Week is by Danny Malone. He'll be releasing a new album November 3rd, and I'm told it was recorded in a 16th century castle in Denmark. This song is called Spider Legs by Danny Malone off his upcoming album, Balloons.
Skin I have. No, no.
You're listening to Earth Sky 22. You can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about the upcoming Hunter's Moon and a star to look for this Halloween, the Ghoul Star, or Demon Star. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. Are you scared yet?
I'm scared.
Okay, let's talk about the Hunter's Moon first.
Okay.
That's a lot less scary than the Ghoul Star. So the Hunter's Moon is a moon that we all look forward to every year. And basically, the Hunter's Moon is the full moon after the Harvest Moon. So the Harvest Moon is the full moon nearest the autumn equinox. The Harvest Moon this year took place in late September. The Hunter's Moon is the full moon after the Harvest Moon, so it's taking place in late October, specifically October 29th.
Okay, and what can we expect to see?
So the full moons of autumn are characterized by their rising time. So what that means is that there's no long period of darkness between sunset and moonrise for several days in a row. And in the past, the first full moon closest to the equinox helped farmers bringing in the crops. They didn't have to, you know, before the days of electricity, they didn't have to stop working in the fields. They could work by the light of the full moon for several days. And, you know, a month later when all the stubble has been, you know, left behind in the field by the harvesters, the farmers now are out hunting and they can see little animals scooting along in the barren fields by the light of the Hunter's Moon.
So that's how it's got its name.
Yeah, that's how it got its name.
Okay. So is it going to be bigger or brighter or more yellow than we would expect to see of a full moon?
Well, that is the myth, isn't it? And so, you know, people think that it's going to be bigger, brighter, yellower. And in fact, it's not. But one thing it is going to be is sort of visible low on the horizon in twilight for several days in a row. And what that means is that people are more likely to see it because you're out and about, you know, in twilight. And you see the moon hanging low in the sky, the full-looking moon hanging low in the sky for several days in a row around October 29th. And when you see a moon low in the sky, you're looking through more air than when you're seeing that same moon overhead. It's the air that makes that golden color. Then the larger-looking size of the full moon seen near the horizon is due to an illusion, which is called the moon illusion. It's an actual psychological effect rather than a physical effect like, you know, air or something, water or something physical. So, the moon isn't actually bigger or brighter or yellower, but if you see it low in the sky on the days around October 29th, you might think it is.
It's all in our heads.
That's right. Well, partly.
Okay.
Mostly, I guess.
So it's almost Halloween. So what does Halloween have to do with astronomy?
Well, people don't know that Halloween is actually an astronomical holiday. And the reason is that it's one of four cross-quarter days. So a cross-quarter day is a day that's more or less midway between an equinox and a solstice. So Halloween is midway between the September equinox and the December solstice. So there are a bunch of different festivals and celebrations that take place around this time. And we in America celebrate with Halloween.
So there's four cross-quarter days per year?
That's right. There's Halloween, which is October 31st, or also November 1st, All Saints Day. Then there's Groundhog Day, which is around February 2nd, May Day around May 1st, and Lammas, which is around August 1st. So those are the four, to us in this culture, best-known holidays around those cross-quarter days.
Okay. And so tell us about this ghoul star.
Yeah. So we always like to talk about the ghoul star around Halloween. And it's a very cool star. It's in the constellation Perseus, the hero, which is ascending in the northeast in the evening hours now. So it's really in a good place to observe. We have a chart of how you can find this star at earthsky.org in case you want to see it. It's really going to be hard for me to explain in words to you how to see it. But we do have a chart. So come to the tonight pages of earthsky.org or else come to earthsky.org and search for Ghoul Star and you'll find this chart. So the deal with this star is all stars have several names. And this star is sometimes called Beta Persei because it's in the constellation. It's the second brightest star in the constellation Perseus. It's also called by the proper name Algol, which comes from the Arabic for ghoul. So the early astronomers knew there was something weird about this star. So what's weird about it is that every 2 days, 20 hours, and 49 minutes, this star undergoes an eclipse. So there's actually another body moving around it. And, you know, there's more about what this body is and the cool things about the system if you do come to the Ghoul Star story at earthsky.org. But let's just leave it for now to say that, you know, at that often, about every 2 to 3 days, this star gets dimmer. And so to the early astronomers, that was weird because most of the stars don't do that. I mean, most of the stars shine very, very steadily. Mm-hmm. So they thought there was something very strange about this star. So they gave it a name that had to do with demons or ghouls. And, you know, so then through time, you know, other ancient cultures also picked up on this association that, you know, they just learned from each other. And so, for example, in Greek mythology and Roman mythology, there was this idea of Medusa, who had snakes instead of hair. And so this ghoul star came to be associated with the monster with snakes instead of hair. So, and that is, in fact, the monster that Perseus, this is the constellation Perseus we're talking about, that witch that had the snakes instead of hair is who Perseus was supposed to have killed. And that's how he became a hero and got to marry the Princess Andromeda and all kinds of cool mythological stuff.
Wow. So look for the Ghoul Star this Halloween and check out the Hunter's Moon.
That's right. And come to earthsky.org if you would like a chart of how to find the Ghoul Star.
Okay, great. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Mike.
This is a new song from Jazz Mills. It's off her upcoming self-titled release. This one's called Little Baby. You're listening to EarthSky 22. You can find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is back to talk about the ruling that took place on October 22nd. Six scientists were convicted of failing to warn the public about a deadly earthquake that took place in Italy just a few years ago. Welcome back, Deborah.
Hey, Mike. So this earthquake happened in 2009. It was in central Italy, and tragically 300 people were killed during the earthquake. The main shock was not a very strong earthquake, actually. It was a 5.8 magnitude earthquake, which is a lot less strong than, say, for example, the magnitude 9 earthquake that struck in Japan in 2011.
Right. A 5.8, usually that doesn't equate to too much damage, usually.
Well, and, you know, I mean, California has earthquakes that size occasionally. And, you know, one thing about, and Japan, of course, has them frequently. And the difference is that the Japanese build for those earthquakes. They know they're in an earthquake-prone area, so their building construction is specifically designed, you know, to prevent damage during earthquakes. Whereas here we're talking about Italy, where there's a lot of very old architecture, and especially a lot of stone architecture. Mm. This earthquake happened at, you know, early in the morning, local time, when people were still asleep. Mm. So you can see that if you were inside of a stone structure when this earthquake struck, you would have a chance of being injured or even killed because, you know, falling rocks and other debris would hurt you.
And how are these scientists responsible?
Well, the scientists were part of what's called in Italy a National Great Risks Commission. We had a lot of response to this story on our Facebook page and from Italy, because we have a big audience there. And people there really felt that the ruling was fair. And apparently part of that reason is that, you know, there's a feeling that government officials are not held responsible for things that happen in that country. So people are angry. In this case, it's a little ironic because earthquakes, you know, scientists everywhere agree that earthquakes cannot be predicted.
Right.
So what happened here was that there were a lot of foreshocks. In fact, from 2008, you know, until the time that this earthquake occurred, there were actually literally thousands of very small earthquakes that occurred in that region. So apparently these scientists told people not to worry. It's just all a natural part of the earth doing its thing. But then what happened was this 5.8 magnitude earthquake struck and 300 people were killed.
So can you explain foreshocks versus aftershocks versus the main shock?
Yeah. It's really easy, you know, in hindsight to tell which are the foreshocks and which are the aftershocks. But in fact, as a series of earthquakes is going on, it's impossible to tell which is which. So say you have a series of small earthquakes occurring, and then you have a slightly larger one. Say you have a magnitude 4 earthquake that occurs. And people say to themselves, well, okay, that was the main shock, and everything before that is the foreshock, and everything after that is the aftershock. Well, then say you have a magnitude 6 earthquake that occurs, and then suddenly that magnitude 4 becomes one of the foreshocks. So what I'm saying is until that series of earthquakes is over and you look back in hindsight, there's really no way to know which ones are the foreshocks and which ones are the aftershocks.
Now, what do you think this means for the relationship between scientists and the general public?
Well, I would think that a lot of the scientists who are involved in studying natural disasters are probably a little unsettled by this. These guys were convicted of manslaughter, and they were given 6 years in prison. So, you know, for other people who study natural disasters around the world, I mean, they don't know. All they can do, I think, is their best. There's no way to predict what nature's going to do in advance, precisely. Scientists would love to know how to predict earthquakes, but they don't know yet how to predict it. And yet, you know, there are 300 people were killed and people were angry and upset about that and looking for someone to put the blame on. So it's a complicated situation as always, and it's a very unfortunate situation.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Mike.
And that's our show. Thank you for listening. This week's show was recorded in Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Special thanks to our musical contributors, Danny Malone, Jazz Mills, Sleep Good, 100 Flowers, and the Black and White Ears. For more on the science or the music you heard, visit earthsky.org. Until next week, be good to one another, and have a happy Halloween. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much hype, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, it's good to have you back.
Kai Rizal, thank you for having me back.
You're very welcome.
I know we're all excited about the second presidential debate last night, yes?
Yeah, it was a good one, don't you think? Interesting.
It was a lot of, I thought, scintillating talk about taxation in particular.
You need to get out more,
Turn you. It did get me to thinking, however, about lying. Now, wow. I don't mean the lying of the sort that each campaign is accusing the other of doing every 2 seconds. I mean, Kai, lying to ourselves.
All right. Go ahead, because I don't know. I have no idea where you're going.
All right, let me explain. Okay. A couple weeks ago, I saw a poll on Yahoo Finance. It asked people, it said that France's wealthiest man is talking about leaving the country to avoid high taxes there. Would you ever leave the U.S., it asked, to avoid high taxation?
Okay.
Now, about a third of the respondents to this poll said, no, I would never leave. But everyone else was willing to entertain the idea. In fact, another third said they would leave the U.S. if taxes were to go higher than even 40%, which isn't really that much of a stretch.
From where they are now. All right, so I'm going to show off here. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, so this is the Laffer curve, right? Arthur Laffer, the economist, and he said, you know, it in theory shows the point at which high taxes make people stop trying to work hard and make money.
That is the theory. Uh-huh. The Laffer curve theory is a bit, however, like a unicorn. We don't really know where that cutoff point is. They are, sometimes they may be. In California, where you
That's
live,
right.
I think more real than in some places. I did ask my economist co-author, Steve Levitt,
yes.
what he would do if, for instance, he had to pay, let's say, 50% in taxes.
All right.
I wouldn't leave the U.S., but I definitely would work less hard. Maybe not at 50%, but at 70 or 80%, I would spend a lot more time playing golf and a lot less time trying to make money, that's for sure.
Oh, please. First of all, the man has, what, 4 or 5 children? How are you going to feed 4 or 5 kids making less money?
Okay.
But
you don't believe him. You're telling.
Here's what I think. I think he's an economist, and he sees this theory, and so he's talking to the theory.
I wouldn't say you're wrong there, but let me also say this. We lie to ourselves all the time. We're constantly trying to predict how we're going to behave in the future in the, you know, when something happens, a tax hike, a price change, a presidential election. And we're almost always wrong. you take something as simple as driving, okay? AAA, the American Automobile Association, is constantly surveying drivers. They'll say something like, you know, if gas prices stay this as high as they are now, go up, will you drive less? And people always say, oh, absolutely. And then you look at the data, and they do not drive less. Here's Joel Weichsel with AAA.
I think there may be people who lie to themselves or imagine that they're doing something that they're not. But I think there are also people who maybe forget about things that they've done.
Forget it. He's being very polite and just saying we're lying to ourselves. That's what he's saying. Right?
It's a synonym.
That's right.
But I will say this. I don't believe it's necessarily intentional, okay? One problem with any survey is that the power of suggestion comes into play.
All right, so, well, let's get it back to the debate then, Dubner, and talk about this idea of polling and people lying to themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, do political polls change behavior, do you think?
Quite possibly, and also we're probably just getting a lot of answers that don't reflect reality, okay? You think about it. What every poll relies on is one stranger telling the truth to another stranger about
That's
the
right.
future, okay?
Yeah.
So there are many ways in which that answer can go wrong.
Yeah.
Nate Silver runs the blog 538.com.
Yep. Yeah, we had him on a couple of weeks ago.
He takes all these different political polls and analyzes them and weights them depending on how good a poll they are. He says, Nate Silver says, it can be hard even to figure out whether a given person will vote at all.
You can ask Americans and say, are you going to vote? But people lie about that, just like they lie about always washing their hands or using condoms or never running a red light or anything else.
I don't even know what to make of this.
Are you depressed yet, Kai?
Is hope lost for being able to do this kind of stuff?
I wouldn't say hope is quite lost, but I will say this. The cardinal rule should be don't listen to what people say, right? Yeah. Watch what they do. So the next time you hear, you know, a friend of yours say, oh, man, if that guy gets elected president, I am out of here. I'm moving to Canada. You go and check back in a year or so. I promise you the odds are pretty good. He hasn't budged an inch, Kai.
Stephen Dubner, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you, man, if you're still in the country.
Thanks, Kai.
See ya.
In our next Freakonomics Radio podcast, it's election time. You want to know what economists are thinking?
I almost never actually listen to politicians. I sometimes read transcripts. And when I read those transcripts, for no matter what the party the person is, I just think, like, I wouldn't give you a C in my economics class. This is just not acceptable for a person to be saying. It's just so wrong.
That's coming up on the next Freakonomics Radio podcast.
Master, do you want to see my Halloween costume?
Igor, aren't you a little bit old to be going trick-or-treating?
But, Master, there is nothing else to do this Halloween.
On the contrary, you could listen to all of the great shows on WHFR this Halloween. You could even call into the station at 313-845-9676 and say, trick-or-treat, and WHFR will send you a Halloween grab bag.
But, Master, I don't have a telephone.
That's no problem, Igor. You could even send an email at whfr-pc@hfcc.edu and type the words trick-or-treat.
I could play all day.
Yes, Igor, you can listen all day, but only one grab bag per person.
Gee, Master, that sounds pretty groovy. Would you like to join me?
Of course, Igor. As for the rest of you, don't forget to listen to WHFR Wednesday, October 31st, and get your Halloween grab bag, too. And as always, keep listening to the station making spooky waves, WHFR.fm.
Oh!
You are round MVP.
Yeah, man! Yo, Drew, I finally got round MVP. Round MVP.
No way! That was some ownage. It's a good thing you got me as your wingman.
Right. You mean when you threw that flash grenade at me?
Whatever, man. Huge round. Seriously, great stuff.
Finally earning round MVP takes determination. So will getting into college. I've got what it takes.
All right, class. I'm going to pass back your tests. And a high score goes to... Brian.
Oh, yeah. High score, baby.
Visit knowhowtogo.org to learn what you should be doing right now to prepare for college. Start taking the steps at knowhowtogo.org.
I've got what it takes. So do you.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation, and the Ad Council.
For more information in Michigan, visit knowhowtogomichigan.org. That's knowhowtogomichigan.org.
Henry Ford Community College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. HFCC was one of only six community college programs studied by Recruiting New Teacher, Inc. and has been the model for other colleges around the nation. For more information about HFCC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
Wake up every Sunday morning with your favorite cup of coffee or Joe and the smooth, relaxing sounds of jazz. Hi, I'm Terrence Tyson, the host of the Play It By Ear show. I invite you to join me each and every Sunday from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. We'll explore jazz from all different angles. I'll be helping to jazz up your weekend right here on the only station making waves at 89.3 FM on the dial and WHFR.FM on the web. I'll see you Sunday.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Host Analytics, a provider of cloud corporate performance management and business analytics, offering products working to impact financial decisions for over a decade. More information at hostanalytics.com/NPR.
And let me make this very clear. I will not raise taxes on the middle class of America.
You can choose a future where we reduce our deficit
without sticking it to the middle class.
We will cut the deficit and put America on track.
Independent experts say that my plan would cut our deficit by $4 trillion.
I have a plan to create 12 million new jobs.
We can create a million new manufacturing jobs in the next 4 years.
Now is the moment where we can stand up and say,
you can make that happen.
I'm an American.
You can choose that future.
I make my destiny.
That's what we can do
in the next 4 years. We deserve better. My children deserve better. My family deserves better. My country deserves better.
Brian, do you vote in presidential elections?
I confess that I do not.
Why not?
I mean, to me, you know, anyone who could actually make it through the system has views that are just so repellent to me, and what they say just seems to be so contrary to common sense and common decency, I just couldn't bear to really identify with either of them.
Okay. So Brian Kaplan is not what a political pollster would call a likely voter, not by a long shot. This can best be explained by the fact that Kaplan is, yes, an economist. He teaches at George Mason University. Kaplan has iconoclastic thoughts about a lot of things. He's the kind of guy who will tell you that just about everything you think about voting, about parenting, about higher education is wrong.
I mean, honestly, just if I just listen to any speech that any successful politician gives, it just seems like it's so unfair and so untruthful. And there's every sentence, like I would say, let's fact check this sentence. Is the sentence actually factually correct? I say, no, not really. It's just a very, you know, very unfair, and you know, just appealing to people's emotions. And that I have to say, I really object to it.
All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they're victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them. Entitled.
Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
I almost never actually listen to politicians. I'll sometimes read transcripts, find the transcripts less emotionally aversive than actually listening to them say their words. And when I read those transcripts, for no matter what the party the person is, I just think, like, I wouldn't give you a C in my economics class. This is just not acceptable for a person to be saying. It's just so wrong.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio, the podcast that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Before the last presidential election in 2008, when Barack Obama beat John McCain, Brian Kaplan published a book called The Myth of the Rational Voter, Why Democracies Choose Bad Policies.
I mean, the background assumption is this. Everyone understands why dictatorships choose bad policies. There's some awful jerk at the head of a country running it like his own personal piggy bank. The puzzle, though, is why democracies would choose bad policies in a similar way. So in other words, the question, like everyone can agree to it, dictatorships choose bad policies. There's no big intellectual puzzle as to why that would happen. But the idea that democracies, which are run by the people or by the people elected by the people, would also make mistakes is the puzzle. So, I mean, you can think about the right way to read the title is why even democracies choose bad policies.
The cover of Kaplan's book shows a flock of sheep standing up like humans in a sort of military formation, ready to follow someone. We the sheeple.
Right, so I'm really going against two different baseline wisdoms. One is with the public, just the idea that if a majority of Americans think something's a good idea, then it's right.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this in almost any presidential debate where someone will say, the American public wants this. And the last thing the other guy is going to say, well, that's true, the American public does want it, but the American public is mistaken for the following reasons. You never want to be the politician saying that. The idea that if something is popular, then it's a good idea is quite widespread in public opinion. At the same time, I also wanted to argue against a view that's become very common in economics and political science, which is that even if there's a lot of ignorance in the public, voters are factually mistaken on a lot of issues, nevertheless, it all balances out so that on average, if the public thinks something is a good idea, then it really is a good idea.
Consider one topic that just about everyone cares about during the upcoming election: unemployment, or really employment. This issue is at the core of both the Obama and Romney campaigns. The argument is over how the Obama White House has done in creating jobs. But as Brian Kaplan points out, not all jobs are created equal. Some of them are what he calls make-work jobs, and that feeds a make-work bias.
I mean, make-work bias is the view that you should judge the performance of an economy based on employment rather than production, which especially during recession is a totally natural view. But once again, if you step back and realize, well, suppose that we had thought this way in the 19th century. Someone comes up with new tractors, new fertilizer, new ways of growing food. Someone else says, well, wait a second, these are going to put farmers out of work. We should stop them. We should ban them. These innovations that sound good because they create more food are going to be bad because they're going to destroy jobs. If we'd listened to those people, we would still be farmers. We'd still be hungry because they weren't growing enough food then. Since we didn't listen to people like this, we had a huge increase in food production. We did have a large decrease in employment in agriculture, but those people and their descendants just found something else to do, which again is so unsatisfying to hear because at the time you want to say, okay, well, tell us specifically what will they do instead of agriculture, which is what mankind's been doing for thousands of years. And the answer really is when you're in a period of change, it's very hard to say what it's going to be. All you can do is say, well, there's going to be something. The labor's valuable. Someone will figure it out.
Well, Brian, how much of the rational voter idea is pegged simply to voting your pocketbook? In other words, voting for the candidate whose policies, or at least the policies that he promises, most closely align with your own economic interests?
So there's actually two separate issues here. So one of them is how clearly or unclearly people see the world. The other one is how selfishly or unselfishly they vote. A person could be very rational but totally unselfish. A person could, first of all, carefully understand the world and then vote on the basis of what he thinks is best for society. Mm-hmm. A person, of course, could be the opposite. A person could be very confused but still voting for what he thinks will advance his selfish interests. What I do in the book is, first of all, I just to clear some rubble away, I go over all the evidence on voter motivation, showing that despite what a lot of people think, voters are shockingly unselfish. Your individual interests have very little to do with how you vote, have very little to do with your views on particular issues. In general, it's not true that rich people are Republican, poor people are Democrats. There's a very slight tendency that way, but it's nothing like the picture that people have of all rich people vote Republican, all poor people vote Democrats.
So that sounds kind of wonderful, yes?
So far, so good. That actually does make democracy sound better. Here's the problem, though. Even though it does look like people really are voting for what they believe to be good for their society, they actually seem to know very little about that. In fact, they have a lot of very mistaken views about how to advance their interests. And I say that's actually probably the worst possible case. The worst possible thing is to have people with good motives but bad understanding, because then there's a lot of agreement and consensus about what we ought to be doing. The problem is just that what we think we ought to be doing is often ineffective or counterproductive.
All right. So in terms of this year's presidential election, pick a plank, any plank, from each candidate's economic platform. And give me an Obama plank and give me a Romney plank. And talk about how good that policy is from an economic perspective, and then talk about its viability as a voting appeal.
I mean, I'd be perfectly happy if you wanted to actually just give me a couple.
Sure. So let's see. So President Obama has talked a lot about financial inequality, but also access to education, let's say, right? So he has made moves toward and talked about making more moves toward making college more affordable in more ways toward more people. Talk to me about that idea as a piece of economic policy, and then talk to me about it as a good piece of voter bait.
All right. So, I mean, at minimum, in terms of economic policy, it's not at all clear that this is a good idea because we already have an enormously high dropout rate, especially for marginal students. Most of the, or at least a lot of the payoff from going to college comes from finishing. And yet, over the last decade or so, we've had a large rise in the number of people who start going to college, but the fraction that actually finishes has been very flat. So, I mean, it seems quite likely anyway that this is just going to encourage a lot of people to waste a couple years of their life and get very little to show for it. And yet, what I just said is not anything you'd ever want to tell voters. You certainly don't want to get in front of a national audience and say, I think too many people would go to college. A lot of people aren't very serious. That's just the fact. A lot of people aren't meant for college. That sounds terrible.
And therefore, campaigning on the idea of sending more people to college is a great thing to campaign on.
Yeah, you know, sounds great. Uh-huh. Of course, we're going to pay for more of this stuff. Sounds good. I mean, who wants to pay for stuff? Right. And again, it's not just a selfish matter of I don't want to have to pay for my kid. No one should have to pay. Wouldn't that be great if no one had to pay?
All right. Let's take something from Governor Romney's campaign. Let's say it's a tax issue. Right. Let's say that the Romney camp describes President Obama's forward-looking tax policy as wanting to raise taxes on the highest earners. Whereas Governor Romney would argue and has argued that that would be a mistake because it would disincentivize small businesses and maybe large, and that there comes a certain point at which raising taxes rather than or at the expense of cutting spending is counterproductive. How does that rank as an economically sound or unsound issue in your view? And how does it rank as, again, voter bait?
I mean, that one is kind of funny because if you take a look at voters' views on government spending, they're literally contradictory. Voters in general favor lower spending overall, but for virtually every category of spending, they want to spend more. So this is the kind of thing where if you say it right, almost anything can be good. If you say it wrong, almost anything can be bad. When a politician says we need to cut spending, that is a popular appeal. The only problem is if someone says, okay, which kind of spending? Oh, let's cut the waste. Can you identify the waste specifically? Is there something that it actually is? So that's the problem. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, in general, Republicans try to tap into the general public desire for lower spending. They also try to very carefully tap into the public's resistance to cutting any particular kind of spending. So even though Republicans know very well that to really cut spending, you've got to cut entitlements. You know, you've got to get Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid under control. Those are really the fast-growing areas of spending. But Republicans are very careful electorally not to name any of those because people are going to say, wait, when I said cut spending, I didn't mean cut any of the kinds of spending we like, which are basically all of them except for foreign aid.
Coming up, my Freakonomics partner Steve Levitt talks about his voting history.
So I voted for Obama because I wanted to tell my grandchildren that I voted for Obama, and I thought that he would be the greatest president in history.
And?
I don't think I'm going to bother voting this election.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, we're talking with economist Brian Kaplan, author of The Myth of the Rational Voter. He is not a huge fan of our current political system.
You know, if you're a successful politician, you know you don't succeed by figuring out what's really going on in the world and then trying to explain it to people. You need to find out what people want to hear and then tell it to them. You know, successful politicians instinctively are trying to read people, trying to read their faces. What does this person want me to say to him? And that's how they win. I mean, economists often look down on politicians and sort of mock them for being incompetent. I have a very different view. I think they're extremely competent. It's just that they're competent at a scale that economists don't appreciate. You know, they are people who win these incredibly competitive races to get a job thousands of people would love to have, maybe millions of people would love to have. They have some incredible skills. It's just their skills are not figuring out what's really going on or deciphering the best research around. Their skill is finding out what the public wants to hear and then saying it to them in a way that is emotionally compelling.
So what bothers you more, that electoral candidates give the people what the people want or seem to want, or that the people seem to want what they seem to want?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because ultimately, the source of the problem is that people are so confused in their views about how the economy and other things work, which means that a politician who wants to win has to actually say these things. I mean, people have often said that politics has been the religion of the 20th century. And I think there's a lot to that. In the same way that people get attached to religion, they get attached to a political party. You know, and once you're part of it, you don't want to hear someone talking about the horrible things that your religion or your party did in the past. You don't want people to go and say the people who now run it might be morally questionable or hypocritical or just wrong. Instead, you want to find a sense of community with a bunch of like-minded people. You all tell each other how wonderful you are and try to defeat your satanic enemies who, for some strange reason, continue to dispute the truth that you have obtained.
Can you answer a couple of questions for Freakonomics Radio?
Freakonomics? I'm not a freak.
My name is Joel, and I grew up in Chicago, but I live here in South Minneapolis right now.
I live in Decatur, Georgia.
Sparta, Wisconsin.
And I live in Lawrenceville.
I'm currently a student at the University of St. Thomas, originally from Fairmont, Minnesota.
So, what political party are you registered with?
Republican.
Republican?
Registered with the Democrats.
I'm registered as a Democrat.
Consider myself a fiscal conservative.
A conservative Democrat.
Can't remember if I actually registered with a party.
Can you tell me one good thing about Barack Obama?
Tell me one good thing about Romney.
Well, hold on for a minute. I got to think about that.
I'm trying to think of how to be polite.
Sorry.
Can I think about that for a while?
Kind of at a loss there.
I'll admit, I have spent a lot of time kind of looking at what's wrong with him instead of thinking about what I like about him.
Barack Obama, I believe, is a good person, a good husband, but he doesn't really reflect any of my views on what's going on today.
He's a family man, and I believe he has the best intentions on running for president.
He can be cool.
Oh, he got a full head of hair.
Great hair.
He's a handsome man.
You know, honestly, I can't think of anything right now that's positive.
People are always talking about the dispiritingly low voter turnout rate in the U.S. It's less than 60% for a presidential election. But after hearing Brian Kaplan talk for a while, you may ask yourself a different but equally dispiriting question. Why is voter turnout even that high? I asked my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt about this recently. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. So, Levitt, how can you in your life when you wander around tell the difference between a smart person and a not-so-smart person?
Well, one good indicator of a person who's not so smart is if they vote in a presidential election because they think their vote might actually decide which candidate wins.
Well, that sounds anti-American, doesn't it? And that's a terrible heresy you're saying aloud.
Well, you know us, Dubner. Well, we try to tell the truth. And the fact is that there has never been and there never will be a vote cast in a presidential election that could possibly be decisive. And one thing we see for sure, and you saw it in the Gore versus Bush election, is that if it's even within thousands of votes, it's not the votes themselves that decide the election, because nobody can figure out how many votes really cast. It's the courts that always decide, the judges who always decide. It's virtually impossible that any vote you cast in a national election could ever actually be decisive.
But don't you think that people pretty much know that by now, that people are aware of electoral versus popular vote? And, you know, if you live in a state like I do, New York, or where you do, Illinois, it's kind of a foregone conclusion. So let's assume that most people kind of think about that and know that. What drives them to do it anyway? I mean, people complain about low voter turnout. Sounds like you're saying it's strange that it's even as high as it is, around 50%.
Yeah, so I think you're right that most people understand that their vote doesn't really matter for the election, which is exactly why I said that I think it's only the not-so-smart people who vote because they're actually going to influence the election. I think the reason most people vote, and the reason that I occasionally vote, is that it's fun. It's fun to vote. It's expressive, and it's a way to say the kind of person you are, and it's a way to be able to say when something goes wrong when the opponent wins, well, I voted against that fool. Or when something goes right when you voted for a guy, to tell your grandchildren, well, I voted for that president. So I have nothing wrong with voting. Just I think you can tell whether someone's smart or not so smart by their reasons for voting.
Why did you vote for Obama for president in 2008?
So I voted for Obama because I wanted to tell my grandchildren that I voted for Obama, and I thought that he would be the greatest president in history.
And?
I don't think I'm going to bother voting this election.
So, Levitt, some places around the world have essentially mandatory voting. Australia, for one. I don't really know too many of the details about it. But as a citizen, you must vote. And there are different incentives for voting and penalties for not voting. Do you like that idea for here?
I think it's totally backwards. Why would you want people who aren't interested in voting? Why would you want to compel them? These are either people who are uninterested in voting, uninformed, indifferent between the candidates. Those are exactly the wrong people to try to get to vote. If anything, I think you want to go the other direction and find ways to let people who care a lot vote repeatedly. That's really more in the spirit of trying to get to the right answer. That way you get the people who have the strongest convictions acting most aggressively to express those convictions.
Can you tell me one good thing about the Democratic Party?
What's something you admire about Republicans?
Their tenacity.
They're very passionate about what they believe in, and they always take into consideration emotion.
I'm not too keen on them because, well, for a lot of reasons.
Well, I truly believe that we all want good for the people.
I don't think there's much that I really admire in the Republican Party these days.
Actually, the Democrat Party that I'm familiar with now is not the Democrat Party that I grew up with.
I feel the Republicans have a much better handle on a free enterprise.
Like most political groups, their heart's in the right place.
There have been good Republicans.
I really cannot think of something that's very good that I've seen.
I don't identify with anything of the Republican Party.
The Democrat Party, I think, has lost its way.
Both parties. I've kind of discussed it with both parties, honestly.
In our next Freakonomics Radio podcast, what do you do when you're a dad and your little girl wants to know how to get the best candy on Halloween night? That's easy. You write to Freakonomics. How to get the most bang for your buck, treats for your trick, Snickers in your knickers. That's coming up on the next Freakonomics Radio podcast.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Catherine Wells, David Herman, Bere Lamb, and Chris Bannon. Colin Campbell is our executive producer. Special thanks to Jake Smith. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com, where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Master, do you want to see my Halloween costume?
Igor, aren't you a little bit old to be going trick-or-treating?
But, Master, there is nothing else to do this Halloween.
On the contrary, you could listen to all of the great shows on WHFR this Halloween. You could even call into the station at 313-845-9676 and say, trick or treat, and WHFR will send you a Halloween grab bag.
But, Master, I don't have a telephone.
That's no problem, Igor. You could even send an email at whfr-pc@hfcc.edu and type the words trick or treat.
I could play all day.
Yes, Igor, you can listen all day, but only one grab bag per person.
Gee, Master, that sounds pretty groovy. Would you like to join me?
Of course, Igor. As for the rest of you, don't forget to listen to WHFR Wednesday, October 31st, and get your Halloween grab bag, too. And as always, keep listening to the station making spooky waves, WHFR.fm.
I'm trying to use the phone!
Hey, loyal listener. Call WHFR at 313-845-9676. Or toll free at 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
What? What?
I couldn't hear that last part.
That's 845-9676 or toll free 1-800-585-HFCC, extension 9676.
Variety's pretty hard to find on today's airwaves. How about joining the cause to promote alternative variety? TCM 189 is the staff training course for HFCC's own WHFR, a station devoted to new, local, and unique artists. The course provides students with essential station procedures as well as equipment knowledge and basic performance skills. The class can be taken for credit or under the Center for Lifelong Learning. For more information, contact Susan McGraw, WHFR's general manager at 313-845-9842.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What do you get when you take a bunch of public radio nerds and shut them in a room with computer geeks? Well, in addition to some bizarrely socially awkward offspring, you get the Public Radio Player. It's a new iPhone app that streams hundreds of public radio stations, including this one, straight to your iPhone and iPod Touch. You can get more information at publicradioplayer.org.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I'm Toni Braxton. And I encourage you to learn the signs of autism at AutismSpeaks.org. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm the Jumper, the host of Cruisin' in Blue.